Well, there's just something about it, though, when you're harvesting a single crop, like if we were just barley silage, I mean, that's what it is. But when you have a polycrop like we have, I mean, to see flowers blooming at the same time when you're harvesting, you have clovers. I mean, in the silage pit, when we pack it in there, I mean, it smells so nice while we're doing our work. I mean, you have these little positive feedbacks that you don't realize impact you, but they do. Yes, we spend lots of hours and, you know, we're outside and we get all the environmental things, but look at my job in the summer. I mean, I'm out in nature, moving an electric fence around, having cattle around me, seeing wildlife, seeing birds, and that's my day. Well, does that sound like a hard job to you?
Sounds like a pretty damn nice day
to me. Regenerative agriculture, making farming fun again, one piece of land, one ecosystem at a time. I'm Derek Leahy, host of the Rural Rooster Climate Solutions podcast.
For me, I find it so exciting. Here I am in my 60s. The next generation comes along with some new ideas and they work. So here I am, instead of just coasting off, I spend so much time learning new things and seeing healthier food being produced, healthier soil, more carbon cycling, more carbon in the soil, and things working better. To me, it's an educational process, learning that there is a different way of doing it, and it works so much more in harmony with nature. I mean, I find it such an exciting time to be able to experience that. And if the next generation had not come along and pushed that on, I would have continued on doing what I was doing, thinking I was doing just fine. And I think that's a situation of a lot of farmers. They think what they're doing is right. Not saying what they're doing is totally wrong, but they're drifting off course and they don't realize it.
Rural Roots to Climate Solutions, in partnership with Regeneration Canada, presents Stories of Regeneration, a podcast series exploring why we, as a society, need to get behind the farmers and ranchers who are regenerating the land, ecosystems, and local economies through their agricultural principles and practices. Farmers and ranchers who are striving for great things through regenerative agriculture. Part 9, Healthy Food, Healthy Environment, with Craig Cameron and Peter Den Oudsten of Peony Farms in Lacombe, Alberta, October 25th, 2023.
Hey, I'm Craig Cameron, and we're out west of Lacombe, Alberta, and we raise forage-finished regenerative beef.
I'm Peter Den Oudsten. We live northwest of Lacombe, and we raise regenerative beef of Piedmontese descent.
Awesome. Yeah, I got a lot of questions about that breed. I gotta say, most producers I talk to have an off-farm job, and I'm just curious if you guys have anything off-farm that keeps you busy.
Nope, we're busy enough on the farm.
There's way too much work on the farm to go work somewhere else.
Yeah, okay, I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
The interview with Peter and Craig was the second last interview we did for the Stories of Regeneration series. Fall was already becoming winter in the prairies, and with the change of seasons and the diminishing sunlight, I became a bit melancholy as I made the drive out to Peony Farms. That melancholy feeling hit me as I began to think about and reminisce about the summer we just had touring around Canada with the Regen Canada crew. It was a whirlwind tour, hectic at times, but man, was it fun capturing all these stories. And seeing the places that were blazing a new trail through regenerative agriculture for the rest of the agriculture sector was also just super humbling and heartwarming to be invited into these trailblazers' lives, even if it was only for one day. So yeah, you know, I got a bit sad thinking it was all coming to an end. So maybe that's why I was late for the interview. Yeah, okay, no, that's definitely not true. I have horrible time management skills. Craig and Peter, if you're listening to this right now, I'm so sorry I kept you waiting for so long. And thank you so much for the dinner I had later that evening. Both Craig and Peter were born into agriculture, but one of them a little sooner than the other. You see, Peter is Craig's father-in-law, and Craig grew up farming on a different farm a couple hours east of Peony Farms. So it was only fair that I directed the question of how the farm got started at Peter instead of Craig.
Well, basically, I started in the pig business. My father was gracious enough to co-sign my farm credit loans. So I bought this existing 80-acre farm, and I started in the pig business of the farrow to wean. And my other brother, oldest brother, he started at the same time on a different quarter section. He built a feeder barn to finish those pigs. We worked together, built our own barns. I did the farrow to wean, sold the pigs to him. He finished them out. We did that for a number of years. And then he decided he wanted to expand and specialize in only hogs and not cropping. So then I went farrow to finish and he did the same thing. I continued to crop as well as raise hogs, and slowly on I built the cattle segment of our farm up. But I was always wanting to recycle the nutrients, so have some livestock, the nutrients, the manure nutrients back on the land, grow my own feed so I had high quality feed back into the pigs.
The recycled nutrients part, I'm curious, at that time, like, how'd that idea come to you? Like, I know we talk a bit more about it now, like, or at least with Regen Ag, talking about integrating livestock to get those nutrients in there, but I think the five principles of Regen Ag hadn't quite come about yet, or at least they weren't public, so I'm kind of curious, how did you get that idea?
Well, it's very interesting how, looking back, I didn't know nothing about regenerative agriculture at the time, but I knew that it was, seemed to me, made a lot more sense to take the nutrients after they've been through the hogs or animals, didn't matter which, put it back on the land, and the crops seemed to respond much better to quote-unquote natural fertilizer, which was manure, and it just seemed to have better quality crops to put back in. I mean, we were conventional in a way, but not really, so we still did use fertilizer, but we only needed to use very small amounts. And our conventional agrologist was always amazed at how good our crops were with how little synthetic fertilizers we were putting on. We used herbicides, but always extremely low rates. And there, it depended on which the herbicide, but we found there were some of them we could put on at half rates. And if we did proper applications and proper timing, we could get good results. I've never used insecticides because they just, it was more from a human health point of view that I didn't want to be around something that toxic. We used a little bit of fungicides, but only very little, and only if the environmental conditions were where it was required. The salesmen were always pushing, oh, put it on, just in case, just in case. Well, I never took that approach. I would only do it if there was a need for it. And then even fungicides, we would only put them on at 3/4 rate. So I've always been hesitant to use synthetic things, not knowing the detrimental effects of it. That was strictly on an economic basis. So now that I've learned more about the regenerative and the negative effects of synthetic fertilizers and herbicides and fungicides and insecticides, it makes more sense that I was hesitant to do it, but I was drifting in that direction without knowing it.
So that's how the farm got started. How, and perhaps more importantly, why the farm started heading down the regenerative path is a pretty unique story in itself.
What led to the transition here? What made you guys decide to start farming regeneratively, or if you're even calling it that at that time?
Yeah, so like what happened was our daughter, Danae, she was born with severe disabilities, and she's fed through a G-tube, so we could put her food directly in her stomach. And so it was kind of one of those things where it's like, well, she's not going to complain like other kids. So we can feed her whatever we want, so we might as well give her the best diet that we possibly can. So then we were kind of like, well, what is the best food that we can be feeding her? And so we dealt with like nutritionists and doctors and everything through the medical system, and then kind of lots of other special needs parents, and kind of asking like, well, what are you seeing and whatever. And we were finding that a lot of the kids that were eating good whole foods were seeing better like medical responses and stuff. Then it's like, well, how far do you go with that? So then Miriam was like, I'm reading all about this grass finish stuff, so that's what we should be feeding her. And I was like, well, I don't know, like, where's the data and this and that. So she ended up going and buying grass-fed beef for in Danae's blends. They're like, okay, we got to research this, because if that actually is the best for her, we should be making it ourselves, because it doesn't make any sense for us to go and buy it from someone else if we, like, naturally we're trying to make the best product. So if this is the best product, it's the best for her, it's the best for our family, that's what we want to make. So then I got digging into the details and stuff, and got interested in John Kemp's work and his podcast, and digging into that. And he's very much talked about, like, he wants to make this high quality food, and that's what he's seeing in the fruits and vegetables. So then it's like, well, let's kind of try going down this road. And we were starting to experiment a little bit. Peter was a little skeptical at the beginning, but we were having enough wins on kind of the trying some things out. Then we sent him with, it was actually Gabe's Brown book, Dirt to Soil. We sent it with him on our trip down to the States.
Okay.
And that's what, I guess you should tell the story from there.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, like, how he was able to get you to go along with this. Like, I'm sure at the time you had some, like, concerns at least. Huh?
Well, I did. And I mean, but I've always wanted to produce food that was good for consumers.
Okay.
So even when I was back in my pig business days, I happened to be looking for heavy-muscled or double-muscled pigs, trying, because I knew consumers were buying meat for the red meat, not the attached fat. Yes, you have to have some fat, but the more red meat, the more desirable a product it would be for a consumer. And so when we started raising cattle, when I started checking into this Piedmontese breed, it was also another case of more red meat, which is a more efficient product to raise, and it's what a consumer is looking for on red meat. So when Craig started coming around with this grass-fed and, you know, regenerative stuff, I was skeptical in that, well, is that actually a better product? When I started reading Gabe Brown's book, and which led me to hours and hours of YouTubes, and the light switch just went on in my head that this is in fact better nutrient dense food that works in harmony with nature instead of fighting against it. And there's been enough people that have done it and proved that it actually works. It's not just some fluffy, wishy, sounds good thing. It's an actual sound scientific process that has good outcomes. Once I realized that, I let the next generation take over. I'll jump in with both feet behind them.
He came back from that trip and he said, I just needed another old guy to tell me I was doing it wrong.
I still haven't quite made up my mind yet if the inspiration for transitioning to regenerative agriculture counts as part of the understanding the context of your farmer ranch principle that keeps coming up again and again in this series. I'm leaning towards it does count, since your own personal motivations for farming or ranching definitely have an impact on the farmer ranch. As for the understanding the context of your farmer ranch principle, as humans, our actions are influenced by many factors, including our environment, community, and finances. In regenerative agriculture, understanding the context begs questions like, does crop selection match the growing climate? Who's involved in the farming operation? Where are farming practices learned? Is the farm profitable in the short and long term? Being aware of the context in which a farmer ranch is managed in can help us recognize obstacles as well as opportunities for improvement. If you go to the Regeneration Canada website, you can read about the 10 principles that we cover in this series. You can also watch some amazing videos and read some great articles about the agriculture producers we interviewed in the series. Peter and Craig go over some of their regenerative agriculture practices in this next part. They, well, perhaps Craig more than Peter, are data obsessed. They do a ton of testing, which definitely helps them understand the context that they're farming and ranching in. And by the way, if it isn't clear quite yet, they run a mixed farm. So they have cattle and they also produce grains.
Well, one of the biggest things in my mind is diversity, because I'm basically come to realize there's so many things I don't know. And the thing about diversity is it's fascinating to find how different plants interact with each other and, you know, have a better outcome because they work together. The other thing is because we have such diverse soils, I mean, we have low spots, we have hilltops, we have good land beside, you have some eroded stuff. They all respond different to different environmental conditions. On a wet year, the low spots drown out, but the hilltops do fantastic. And on a dry year, it's exactly the opposite. Well, if you only seed one kind of crop, if it doesn't handle wet feet, they're going to be bare areas in the low spot. Whereas if with this diverse mix, it's incredible how some plants seem to do better on the hilltops, some do better in the low spots where they had flooding for a short period of time in the spring. And just as diversity works together on a simple production basis. But now finding out more how different kinds of plants interact with each other and how different plants put out different things into the soil to feed the organisms in the soil, it just makes more sense to have diversity, because I came from a background not really concentrating on what's going on in the soil. Mm-hmm. And the amazing eye-opener about this regenerative stuff is focusing on having the organism, the soil, healthy and functioning well. And when they function well and you give them a good environment, they feed the plants. And the conventional thing is, well, you just put synthetic inputs in to feed the plant and that'll be good enough. Well, this approach is make the soil healthy, make the organisms healthy in the soil, and they will feed the plants and you won't need to put very many synthetic inputs on.
How does integrating livestock fit into creating that healthy soil you're talking about?
Well, if you raise herbivores, which is basically cattle, sheep, or goats, or anything, you're crazy not to use regenerative principles.
Yeah.
Because the fastest way to integrate this is through diversity. And if you're trying to harvest crops to sell on the commodity market, it's difficult to separate out a number of different crops. But if you can grow livestock feed and have the livestock eating this polycultures on the land, it's so incredibly important that you have animals, because it improves the plant life and the soil, organisms in the soil. So they work together. So the easiest farmers to change to regenerative principles are those that have livestock already.
Okay. Any other regenerative practices you guys want to highlight?
Yeah, I think, well, the two biggest, in my opinion, are our testing processes, because they help us understand the context. They help us understand what's going on in our system and allow us to adapt to that. And then the other part would definitely be diversity. The diversity, super important for the nutrient density of the products we're raising, the feed quality value of the plants that are on the land, and the soil microbiome based on the different root exudates that they're putting out.
With like your cash crops, do you integrate livestock into that as well, or is it just strictly for forage crops?
This year, they were on farther away land with no fences and stuff, so we couldn't integrate them.
Okay.
But with the, we did have a little bit of cover crop seeded under them, so we could have put livestock on in the fall if we had the right conditions and fencing and everything for them. Yeah.
Still use a bit of synthetics, or have you guys got off it entirely?
Nope. We use a small amount of synthetics. Next year we won't use any nitrogen, just based on our testing. This year we used 8 pounds of N and that was it. So yeah. But we find micronutrients super important. We're working with the lab that we work with on our soil and sap testing, we're looking to grow our crops driven by calcium rather than nitrogen. So with the calcium will pull a lot of the other micronutrients, make them more available and into the plant. Mm-hmm. And then the plant can get most of its nitrogen from microbes. And especially in our polycrops where we have nitrogen fixing specific plants in there, we got more nitrogen than we need.
Okay. So, I mean, it's a good problem to have.
Yeah. And so we want to make sure we have the right micros in there to keep the plants healthy, but also to make sure the end product is healthy as well.
And then like any other inputs that you're throwing in?
We do some compost. Part of, again, working with this lab on our soil and sap testing is to get all these things available, it's really important to have a proper humic to fulvic acid ratio in the soil. And so when we were spreading fresh manure, we were getting just the nutrient value, but it's very high in fulvic. So then our fulvic to humic ratio on our worst field was 20-1. And we want to be closer to a 1-1. So then a composted manure, then we're a much higher humic level. Okay. So now we've gone to composting all our manure and then applying that rather than straight raw manure.
Okay. And are you having to ship it in, or you guys got plenty of your own?
Just our own. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Cover crops at all, or?
Yeah. Like the diversity, like the crops that we have, like those silage crops, they are basically a big multi-cover crop.
That's really your point. Yeah.
And so that the other part that those help with is because there, we have lots of regrowth species in there. Then we have roots in the ground all year.
Okay.
We have soil cover from those plants all year. Diversity just by far is one of the most beneficial things I think on the regenerative production side of things.
Okay. And that seemed to be like the spot you folks started at, eh? Like, was when you wanted to get kind of a nutrient dense product, that like diversity was sort of the first step in all that.
The first step was actually our testing.
Okay.
And I think that's actually one of the easiest ways for anyone to get into this is to just start sap testing. And say, okay, this is what we're seeing in the actual plants, and they have enough nitrogen, but they're short on something else. Mm. Well, then you can tweak your fertilizer down a little bit, start playing with stuff that way.
Okay.
And it makes it super easy, whereas like you have to have either livestock or an understanding of what you want out of your cover crops if you're going to grow cover crops in, say, a grain scenario. Mm. It's a little trickier to kind of jump on that right away. But then when we were starting with the testing and then we started doing cover crops and stuff, then we could, with the testing, see that the cover crops were making a difference, and then we could keep going down that road.
Correlation isn't always causation, but I'm curious, like, have you noticed any results since you made the transition to regenerative agriculture that may be attributed to the fact that you changed the way you farm and ranch around here?
Yeah, our feed quality is way better. We've been able to cut back on a lot of our, we were talking about cutting back on our fertilizer inputs and stuff, but also on like livestock minerals and that type of thing, because we're getting all that through the plants. Getting some of the water movement that we talked about earlier that we're seeing in the good, better structured soils.
Yeah, we're starting to see more earthworms
In
the soil through the no-till practices and, having the ground covered and, have a living root, going from spring to fall, and they're still living roots, even though now it's just starting to freeze up. It makes it fun to go out and see flowers at all times of the year.
Yeah, I guess it would. And even like with, like you said, the quality of your feed's gone up. Like, have you noticed the impact that's had on the cows? Like, is productivity or fertility gone up at all?
Fertility's been better. Yeah.
Yeah, much better.
Much better.
Yeah. Okay.
And the soil smells better.
That's right, you did make us smell the soil when we were here in September.
As part of the Stories of Regeneration project, Regeneration Canada partnered with P&E Farms to host a really great field day, as well as a farm-to-table dinner where I ate way too much. Both were at P&E Farms, and they took place about a month before the interview. I mentioned that Craig and Peter are data-obsessed. Again, probably more so Craig than Peter. They're also diversity-obsessed. They'd get along really well with Aaron Goodard of Snowy Mountain Farms in British Columbia, who we heard from in part 6. Now, I always thought the gold standard for on-farm biodiversity was perennial pastures, at least out here in the prairies. You know, that idea that cultivated lands just can't compete with the diversity you can find in a meadow. Surprisingly, Craig and Peter wanted even more diversity than could be found in their pastures, so they threw in a bunch of annual crops into the mix. Some of you have probably heard of grass-finished beef before. The beef from Peony Farms is marketed a little bit differently. They call it forage-finished beef.
Yeah, so basically forage finishing comes from the research being done by Dr. Van Vliet and some of the research that he's pulled from as he's been putting together his research study through the, I can't remember what university he's with, but he's at Bionutrient Food Association's involved with this project. Because I'm interested in what's the best food, I kind of am following the Bionutrient Food Association, and they were talking about this study, so then I was learning about that. And the preliminary results from the study were showing that the best grain fed is actually better than the worst grass fed on a lot of like nutrient density parameters that they're looking at. But then the best grass fed is like 10 times better than that. And that is the grass fed that's on a variety of forage species. So the more diversity of the diet that these animals are eating, the more diversity of compounds they're finding in the meat that could lead to better human health outcomes. So then it was like, well, if the worst grass finished is worse than the best grain finished, well, is grass finished really what we're targeting? And if we're looking for a diversity of species, maybe we need more of a word or a name to indicate that these animals are raised on that diversity. Mm-hmm. So that's where we came up with the idea of forage finished, just to indicate that it's a diversity of forages these are eating, not just one type of grass.
Is it a mix of like perennials and annuals on like one pasture, or like how's that work?
Yeah, they get all sorts of different things. So they're on some perennial pastures for part of the year. They're on some annual blends. They're on, we had one field that we had some perennial, some biannual, some annuals. So yeah, as much diversity as we can give them right now.
Very cool. But yeah, just like curious, like I guess like one route you could have went to was like, okay, we'll just focus on our perennials and we'll just like build up the diversity there. But you guys decided to do a little bit of everything. I'm just curious why you decided to go that way.
We like trying things.
Well, yeah, and the other thing that I forgot in the mix, I didn't say that we had plantain and chicory.
All right.
And like in the plantain, blends. I mean, that's a natural dewormer. So, I mean, it's just, there's not a lot of it, but it gives the cattle the choice to eat that. And through that, we quit using wormers, ivermectin, and because we learned that if you put ivermectin on cattle, well, that comes through with the manure and it kills the insects which are trying to process the manure on the pasture. So we haven't seen it yet, but other regenerative farmers after a number of years will see dung beetles come back and things like that to speed up the process of getting the manure back into the soil and a usable thing. So it's just the variety, and through Dr. Van Vliet's work, I mean, he's shown that different kind of plants make the meat different, which means it different for the person that's eating it too. The thing that he said, which I find fascinating, is on a human health basis, if we tell people, well, let's put somebody on a Mediterranean diet for 8 weeks and somebody on a conventional diet for 8 weeks and test their blood and things like that, would you expect to see any difference? Well, everybody's going to say, of course you'll see a difference. Mm. Well, here are the animals. If we are only feeding them a single diet, well, maybe one or two things, and the other cattle are fed a diverse forage mix with all sorts of different compounds in it from different kinds of plants, well, it just stands to reason that they would be a different outcome in how healthy the animals would be and the compounds in it. So if the animal is there, well, it's obvious it's in their meat. So when people eat it, well, we get the benefits. Mm. So it just comes back to our mindset of diversity is an incredible thing to embrace. And the original prairies or any environment, there was never monocultures. There was diversity, incredible diversity. We should try and get back to the way it was and embrace diversity and make meat available to people that has diversity in it.
This might be an odd question, but do you guys have like a diversity goal? Like, you know, we want a 150 species cover crop one day or something like that? Or I'm just curious, yeah, like, what's, like, what are you striving for, I suppose?
We'll just keep playing with it and see what happens.
Oh, one thing I was curious about with marketing forage finished cattle, was that challenging at first? I feel like you can kind of market grass finished okay, like consumers are slowly becoming a bit more aware of it. But yeah, I think if you went to like somebody in Red Deer right now and said, yeah, you want to buy some forage finished beef, they'd kind of look at you with like glazed looks. So yeah, I'm just curious, was it difficult to market it?
Well, that's where we're starting to do this marketing ourselves kind of thing, because all of our sales up till now have been based on that Piedmontese genetics, right? Mm. So now we're starting to roll into that, trying to build a market for the forage finished side of things. But I think it's something that you have to explain it a bunch of times, but by the time you've explained it a bunch of times, people kind of get the idea and be able to run with it. So
let's talk about Piedmontese, because it's not really a breed I'm super familiar with. Did you just get sick of seeing Black Angus all over the place and decided to switch it up? Or what made you choose to go with those ones?
How I started with it is my parents came from Holland, and I have uncles in Holland that were in the dairy business, as well as my family. In Holland in the 70s, they had an overproduction of milk, and so they had these dairy cows that they basically had to produce beef out of them. They found out there was this breed in Italy called Piedmontese that they got semen from, imported into Holland, and in one cross, they could change a dairy cow and have a beef calf out of it, because they're what's commonly called a double-muscled breed. It's basically the myostatin is inactive, and it causes an animal to have huge rolling muscles. The Piedmontese has the unique feature of a calf from a Piedmontese is born without the double muscling, and it develops it after, because there are many breeds that carry this double muscle gene, but it's a detriment because it's a serious calving problem, because these calves are blocky and have these muscles and they can't get out the birth canal. Well, the Piedmontese is unique in that they're born without the double muscling. Also, we didn't find this out till about 2000. The Piedmontese myostatin gene also carries a tenderness gene. So every animal that carries a Piedmontese carries a tenderness gene. And nowadays, that is huge in consumer, how they respond to a product. Because consumers nowadays are used to cookie cutter products. You buy one today, better be the same tomorrow, and the day after, and the day after, and the day, every one of them is identical. Well, in beef, marbling is the standard as to what is quality beef nowadays. But very few people realize that marbling is only a 50% indicator of eating quality. It's that low. With the Piedmontese being also naturally leaner, it's more efficient to raise a Piedmontese animal, because fat is stored energy. It takes much less food to put on a pound of red meat than it does a pound of fat. And nowadays, most consumers do not want to eat surface fat. Marbling is a great thing, but surface fat is basically a waste, because it takes feed in the conventional feedlots to put fat on, and then the packing plant, they cut it off. Well, the Piedmontese has a little bit of marbling to make eating quality, but has very little surface fat. Basically, the Piedmontese is an excellent breed for a terminal sire. So you take cows that are excellent in your environmental conditions, and that'll be different where we are here, where we have lots of feed, or if you're in dry conditions where the cow's got to walk a long ways and on short grass, or in deserts, or in the tropics where they're heat resistant is an issue. You just put a Piedmontese bull on another beef breed and you get all these meat qualities and the tenderness gene in a single cross.
Is there a downside to Piedmontese? Like, it seems like it's such a great eating experience, yet when I drove up here, I saw nothing but Angus.
Yes. The downside to them is they don't have thick skin and they don't have surface fat.
On the purebreds.
On the purebreds. So here in Alberta, during 4 or 5 months of the winter, we need to feed them more energy to for them to stay warm. During the summer months, it doesn't matter. But during the winter, we do have to give them more energy for them to maintain their body condition. So a Piedmontese is not the ideal cow for this climate. You're better off only having one bull and having 20 cows that can winter well, and just using the bull to make this meat and get these fantastic meat qualities in one cross. Okay. Double muscling is the common term. I think the scientific term is hypertrophy. And all mammals carry a myostatin gene. And a myostatin gene basically tells an animal, any mammal, as it's growing, you have enough muscles, stop growing more muscles. You are normal. In the Piedmontese, there is a defective myostatin gene. And basically what happens is it doesn't trigger in to stop making muscle growth. So a Piedmontese animal will have approximately between 5 and 8% more muscle mass compared to the structure of the body, you know, skeleton, bones, and tendons and things like that.
You can tell it's fairly important to Craig and Peter to give people the best eating experience possible and provide them with food packed full of nutrients. To make sure Peony Farms is on track for both of these, they do a heck of a lot of testing so they can get a better idea of what's going on in the cow, the soil, and the plants.
Yeah, so I guess since we were just talking about the Piedmontese, we'll say the first test we do is we check for that myostatin, make sure that all the bulls that we're using have two copies of the myostatin gene, so that when we cross them on another animal for those meat benefits, they have that one copy to make sure that they're tender and there is some other little health benefits and stuff that are supposed to come with the gene as well. Then if we go to the soil, we do soil testing, working with the Future Analytics in Red Deer. That is all done by reduced chemistry rather than oxidized chemistry. So most conventional soil testing methods are by oxidized chemistry. And so you see a little bit different things in the results you get because of that different chemistry for extraction. The chemistry that she's doing there is very similar to like what the plant acids and stuff would be putting out to get nutrients out of the soil. So we're doing kind of a very, very natural process to see what would be coming out of there. And then we can also see these interactions. So in an oxidized chemistry, we're basically taking all of the nutrients and finding out what the totals are is there. Whereas with reduced, we can kind of look at the interactions and we can see, okay, we have this much calcium available, but only this much is what the plant's getting access to. And so why is that? And then we look, oh, well, our humic to fulvic acid ratio is out. So if we correct that, then more of this calcium will be coming through to the plant.
Okay. All right. So yeah, the reduced chemistry is how you figure out what the plant can access, as opposed to like the oxidized. It would just be like, this is what's in the soil. Yeah. Hopefully some of it's getting to the plant. It might not though.
Yeah. And so also with the reduced chemistry, we're able to look at all of the transition metals in the periodic table. Whereas with most oxidized chemistry, we're looking mostly at the two ends of the periodic table, like your potassium, nitrogen, magnesium, some of those things rather than seeing what the transition metals are doing. So then when we're looking at that, we're looking at humic fulvic acid ratio to then drive the calcium, and then that we can make available more of the micros like your copper and some of those things. We also look at the iron to manganese ratio because that seems to be really important for proper plant growth as well.
Did any of that make you think, oh crap? Like, I'm just thinking, like, most producers you hear about NPK and it kind of stops there, but now you two got to worry about the entire damn periodic table. Like, are you, at any point, like, Christ, what have we got ourselves into, sort of thing?
Well, my degree is in environmental chemistry, so I'm just in my glory. So soil tests are once a year. So we'll soil test now in the fall, and then next growing season, then we'll do a number of sap tests. So sap testing, we also do through Future Analytics, and it's basically looking at the fluid in the leaves. And when we look at the nutrients in that fluid from a new leaf versus an old leaf, then we can see whether, so with mobile nutrients, we want more of that nutrient in the new leaf than the old leaf because the plant is moving that nutrient up there to grow the new leaves. Whereas if we are looking at an immobile nutrient, then we want to see more of that nutrient in the old leaves because that plant is still building that nutrient level in the new leaves, but it hasn't caught up to where the old leaf is. And if we see disparities like on a immobile nutrient that's flipped, then we have an issue somewhere that we have to go looking. Well, is it because there's a deficiency of this nutrient, or because we're looking at interactions, is it something going on with another nutrient that's leading to this nutrient being out of whack? But as we've been doing this for a while now, we're getting pretty close to where we're not having to tweak near as much as we used to.
And like price point wise, like testing as often as you do, is it worth it? Or is it like saving you money someplace else because you're doing all this testing?
Yeah, it's saving us on fertilizer.
Okay, yeah. That's a good spot to save.
Yeah. When we started testing, we were still fully conventional and like full fertilizer program for what we were doing, which is low compared to other guys, but it still was enough. And we were able right away to cut it. I think we cut it 20% the first year just from the testing, being like, oh, we don't need this.
It's a good thing to find out.
Yeah.
Having the tests gives you so much comfort in knowing that you're not heading off in the wrong direction. I mean, we see that the plants are in balance, and then we see the feed results after we harvest those plants and find out, hey, these plants are much healthier. The important components are in balance. Mm. So it only makes sense that we're making improvements on the soil too. So by this testing, we're hitting all the spots. We're improving the soil, we're improving the plants, and we're improving the animals. So it only makes sense then that we have a higher quality product to offer the consumers.
Do you think you could like come to some of these conclusions just by observing above ground growth? Or will that just be like a lot of walking, a lot of acres?
I think it's possible. The trouble is sometimes you can have deficiencies and stuff and not notice it until you have a problem, right? Mm. Whereas if you're testing it, you can see, oh, well, if we just do this little bit, it's going to make a big difference down the road, rather than, well, everything seems fine, all of a sudden we have a big problem because it's been slowly getting worse kind of thing. I don't know. That's kind
of... Well, that makes it so you can get in front of it before it does become problematic.
So, like, one of the things with regenerative agriculture that I see is different from conventional or organic, I found operating in both conventional and organic, we missed three key things. We missed that people are a part of the system. We missed that the system's really dynamic. It's not static. And we missed that there's feedback loops. So now in regenerative, well, we're doing the testing, but even just visual feedback loops, visual like smell feedback loops, we can see, yeah, the cattle are getting pregnant better, they're healthier. That's a feedback loop. Like there's all these different feedback loops we can look at, and the testing is just one step further that we've decided to go in trying to read those feedback loops, figure out where we're at and how we can improve going forward.
Tied in with that,
yeah.
Basically, I've learned that there's always, if you do something wrong, there's always a consequence. Sometimes the consequence is immediate. Okay. If you put your finger on the hot stove, you get feedback instantly, you pulled your hand away. There are other things that you can get away with for a while, but it gradually deteriorates and it comes back. And some things can go on for a long time before you notice the problem. And what I've seen is with putting synthetic inputs on crops, when nitrogen came out, it had a phenomenal response. So that's the way we jumped on board conventional agriculture. But after a while, you had to put more nitrogen on, or it caused a problem with disease susceptible plants or plants that had no strength. A storm came along, they all laid over flat. Then you came out with a fungicide, you came out with a herbicide, and you could keep going a ways further. But now we're getting to the point where we're getting weeds that are resistant to herbicides. Well, they come up with a new one. Well, for the first while, it seemed like every year there were coming up new ones. Now they're finding it's more and more difficult to come up with it. And we're finding the problem is we've been destroying the soil without knowing it. And I mean, I know that myself. I mean, I've put 35 crops in the ground and I didn't realize the problems I was causing. But now that we know, if we were destroying the soil, that is what is causing the problems. And I mean, I don't hold it against anybody that's conventionally farming because I did it myself. But as we learn, we should take small steps and try and get headed in the right direction instead of putting more of this, more of that, and having such poor quality, not nutrient-dense foods.
Throughout the Stories of Regeneration series, I've really enjoyed getting the thoughts of agriculture producers on what they think consumers can do to accelerate adoption rates of regenerative agriculture in Canada and beyond. Voting with one's dollars was often the answer, but there was also a few other gems in there. And as the Stories of Regeneration series progressed, our answer to that consumer piece has gone from voting with one's dollars to sharing the risks with agriculture producers to becoming partners with farmers and ranchers in accelerating adoption rates of regenerative agriculture. Here's what Craig and Peter have to say about the role that consumers play in the Regen Ag movement.
I think they have the biggest role.
Go on.
Well, like if we go back to living out of our values and that farmers are just an extension of the societal values, then it becomes really important for the society to either figure out what those values are and say, okay, these are the values we want. The values that are working with regenerative agriculture, that's what we want. And then that's what gets practiced. Whereas if the societal values are, well, we just want to maximize the volume of cheap calories, well, that's just going to keep taking us down the path that we already are. And so I think the society or the people that are driving this, that's they have the biggest role.
That's fair. I'm not like, and you're right, I think society does want cheap calories, but there's obviously the demand now to like stop biodiversity from collapsing and like address climate change. So I guess it's kind of there. I'm just trying to figure out like, what does the consumer do? Like, we don't have a Regen Ag certification at this point, for better or for worse. I know it can be a bit of a controversial topic sometimes. So, like, yeah, how does... I'm just trying to think of, like, practical tips for a consumer.
Yeah, like, I think getting to know farmers that are doing regenerative practice, like, doing regenerative agriculture, because I think it's so difficult to come up with a certification that encompasses all this, all this thing, that it's really important to find ways... And on the farmer side, find ways to get product to consumers, but also on the consumer side to be like, okay, we're going to go look for people that are putting human and environmental health first and kind of finding ways to get together and make that happen. And also on the producer's end, like we try not to have the most expensive products out there because that's also, we want people to have this better food. So it's like trying to, because we have to get paid for what we do, but we don't want to be like making it hard for the consumer. So that's always a dance too, to try and find ways to balance those needs as well. But I think having those conversations with producers and being able to come to some sort of spot where everybody wins, I think is really, really good.
I agree. I was just having, when I was out in BC talking to the fruit farmer there, it was just like, how much, and neither one of us had an answer, like how much can we expect a producer to know about like intercropping or rotational grazing or all that kind of stuff that like we talk about quite easily, but like for them to go up to like a farmer to fruit stand or whatever to say like, oh, like how many species do you have in your polyculture stuff? Like where, like what's reasonable and what's completely just out there, you know?
So, I think that's where even like some of those detailed questions aren't even necessarily as important as asking the farmer, like, what are you doing to promote human health? What are you doing to promote environmental health? And then they get a chance to say, well, I'm not doing anything about that. Or they get a chance to say, well, I am doing some cover crops or I am doing this. And you can get a lot out of just asking that one simple question, I think.
What a scary question to be asked, though. You're just like enjoying your coffee and somebody comes up to you. So what are you doing about human health, by the way?
Yeah.
But no, you're right. Like, that's like anybody can ask that question, you know, and like the answer doesn't have to be like complex either.
Yeah. But the consumers have to realize if they target their dollars by buying the cheapest food that degrades the environment, there are consequences to that. And if they were to shift their buying powers to stuff that does support regenerative agriculture, it makes a difference. And I mean, for me, it's kind of interesting whether you buy into all this climate change and carbon stuff or not. Through regenerative agriculture, we are cycling way more carbon through the soil, and a side benefit is more carbon gets stored in the soil.
To end the episode, one of my favorite questions.
In your own words, what is a regenerative mindset? I could start with Craig, then go to Peter if you want.
That was too good not to share. I eventually did get an answer out of both of them. The reason I'm such a fan of any question about the regenerative mindset, and we did an entire podcast episode about the regenerative mindset, I think it was episode 47, but my love of the question comes from the fact that changing a mindset on anything might be difficult, but once you make that shift in mindset, the sky's the limit as to what you can do with it. It provides a solid foundation for innovation and adaptation, something the world really needs right now. And sure, you can learn and master a regenerative practice like cover cropping or rotational grazing. But if you embrace, if you adopt a regenerative mindset, you're constantly looking for ways to regenerate the land, ecosystems, even communities. Like I said, sky's the limit.
Regenerative mindset. So I guess for me, the mindset is almost the most important part, the mind shift, the beginning to understand, like I said, that people are a part of this system. It's going to be coming from our values and our beliefs and our goals, what this system is going to become. And so that's really important. And then also the other end of things, people are a part of it where we're the recipients of what the system puts out. So if we put in the right values, beliefs, and goals, we'll get out the end product that comes from that. As farmers, we're kind of, I feel we're the extension of the rest of society's values, beliefs, and goals, and we're the ones just putting that into practice. To me, that's very important. Like, that's the base level. And so for me, that's been just the two simple things of human health and environmental health. If what we're doing builds human health and environmental health, we're doing a good thing. That means that I don't have to get tied into, I have to do everything XYZ or in this sequence because that doesn't work, because my one field has a difference between one end and the other, let alone between fields, let alone between farmers, let alone across the country. And that's where I really got frustrated, I guess, with organic, where it's, this is what your criteria are. It doesn't matter where you are or what you do. And it was I felt limiting on building that nutrient density, that healthy food and healthy environment. So I think it's, very important that then we're living out of that. If it's good for human health and it's good for environmental health, then it's regenerative. And so then, building that mindset of everything I do, I'm going to do it to improve human health and environmental health.
You think you could farm regeneratively without a regenerative mindset? Just like, the big companies that want it right now. So you could get paid to farm regeneratively. Why do you need a mindset to do it?
I think it'd be very difficult.
Okay.
So a lot of this comes from working with a life coach and business coach, just trying to develop in myself the skills I need to go through life, I guess. And just realizing how much what I do is dependent on what my values are. And I'm able to overcome a lot more adversity and a lot more conflict and a lot more what's coming against me if I'm living out of my values rather than if I'm just doing it for the money. And so I think that's where, yes, it's a nice idea that we can just say, here, this is what you farmers have to do to go and get your regenerative certification and get paid for this. As soon as you start seeing, well, I'm having way too many weed problems, or it makes it really difficult to keep going on that path. Whereas if you're coming at it from a value of, I want to make the best for human health, I want to make the best for environmental health, well, we can work around that problem. Mm-hmm. We use cattle in that situation and use that as cattle feed if it's too weedy of a field, or we use it as, if you're just a grain farmer, as a green manure crop or whatever. Like, you can find ways to work around these problems if there's not a cop-out where you're living out of these values and not, well, this isn't going to work for me anymore because I'm seeing too many problems. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does. It almost doesn't, like, the mindset gives you, like, more options. So, like, if you're just purely, like, obviously economics is still important, but if you're purely in it for that, like, the tools you have at your disposal, it's kind of few. But I don't know. Almost sounds like, the way you talk about values, it almost sounds like it's an agriculture input.
Yeah.
And using that, like, well, that means I could do this, I could do that, I could do this. And as a guy who likes to try a bunch of new things, it seems like a really good fit for you then, yeah.
Well, I see it as making sure you focus on all aspects. And I think one of the problems with conventional agriculture is we have lost track of the soil. We don't realize how important the soil is and the organisms in the soil. We have to focus on where everything starts. I mean, there's so many components, but if you don't focus on the basic building block, which is the soil, and getting that healthy, there are going to be problems coming all the way along. I just look at, as a farmer, I like to be able to leave the land in a better state than when I took it over, so that there's a future for the future generations. We have to concentrate on doing practices that make the soil healthier. Because if the soil is healthier, the plants are healthier, the animals are healthier. As humans, we have healthier food. And it's one of these classic problems of the economics. The farmers aren't rewarded relative to the effort they put in, but it's still the satisfaction of knowing you have created a healthy food and you've made the land a better place when you're done, because the side benefits are the diversity. I mean, the wildlife, the birds and things like that, which start showing up when you are doing things right and not just doing it for the economic value. I mean, the tons of grain that you produce off the land or the pounds of beef you sell. There has to be a way of doing it that benefits every part of the system. And I think regenerative agriculture ticks all the boxes.
Thanks for listening to part 9 of Stories of Regeneration. We have one more episode to go, and it's surprisingly about one of the very first farms I worked on when I came back to Canada over 10 years ago after spending my 20s bouncing around the world. The name of that farm is the Just Food Community Farm, and it's located in Ottawa, Ontario. Be sure to download and listen. Rural Roots to Climate Solutions is an Alberta-based organization empowering agriculture producers and the communities they live in with climate solutions. Rural Roots runs workshops, farm field days, webinars, and participant-driven projects like the Siksikaitsitipi Agriculture Project and the Regenerative Agriculture Lab. We produce a farmer's blog, and of course, we do this podcast. For more information about us and what we do, go to the website, which is www.rr2cs.ca. The rest of the amazing and talented Rural Roots to Climate Solutions team is Cheyenne Younger, Kristen Mountain, Shelley Seed, and Lance Tailfeathers. The podcast is funded by a variety of Alberta-based funders and funders based in other parts of Canada. The Stories of Regeneration project is primarily funded by Agriculture and Agri-Foods Canada. The project's led by Regeneration Canada, a fantastic not-for-profit organization that advocates for soil health to mitigate climate change and guarantee a healthy food system. It's an organization that Rural Roots is proud to partner with. For additional information, videos, blog posts, digital materials about the agriculture producers featured throughout the series, visit regenerationcanada.org. A big shout out to Antonius, Sarah, Ali, Paige, and Genevieve from the Regeneration Canada team, and Jean-Marc, Phil, and Obed from the film crew, who all worked tirelessly to bring this project to life. It was an absolute pleasure working with you folks. The interview with Craig and Peter was recorded on Treaty 6 lands and in the Métis Nation of Alberta. And my parts of this episode were recorded on Treaty 7 lands and in the Métis Nation of Alberta Region 3. Happy farming wherever you are in the world. And remember, what's good for the climate is good for the farm.